Time Blong Master, the Australian involvement with Papua New Guinea.
As a matter of fact, it was the coldest night I have ever spent in my life. We crossed at 11,000 feet. When I say cross, we couldn't cross. We got caught at 11,000. And Anderson and I were going up with the police, hitting the carriers, not belting them with sticks, but hitting them with open hands to keep the circulation going. We knew once they stopped, they'd die. So we eventually got them into camp at 11,000 feet, and it was limestone country and no water. But we could hear a creek right down below, and there was a hole big enough to get a bucket down. And we lowered the bucket and got water enough to cook their rice, enough for us to cook our food.
The voice of former Papuan Patrol officer Claude Champion recalling his experiences in 1937 in the fearsome limestone mountains guarding the Southern Highlands. The limestone barrier mountains in Papua and the enormous peaks and rift valleys on the New Guinea side helped prevent the laborious foot patrols led by Australian patrol officers, miners and prospectors from making contact with up to a million Papua New Guineans living undisturbed in their high, fertile mountain valleys. The outside world only began to be aware of their existence in the mid-1920s, and the last major pre-war exploratory patrol was mounted in 1938. Into the Highlands is the first of two programs dealing with Australian penetration of the Stone Age cultures in central Papua New Guinea. Dr. Hank Nelson.
Missionaries, adventurers, miners and government officers made frequent attempts to penetrate the interior of Papua New Guinea. Some returned to claim success, three at least, wrote books of the fantastic sights they had seen. Cavalry mounted on yellow and white striped ponies, giant apes, and peaks higher than Everest. They were written by men with more imagination than bushmanship. Their claims might have won brief acceptance in London, New York, or Sydney, but not in Port Moresby or Madang. There, it was generally believed that as you approached the centre of the island, the mountains became higher, the country more broken, and the population more sparse. That vast tract of land, from the Markham Valley in the east, running over 300 miles west to the Dutch border and beyond, was one of the last mysteries for the mapmakers of the literate world.
By the 1920s, white men had three routes to the edge of the Central Highlands. From the east, they could attempt to climb out of the broad Markham and Ramu valleys. In the south, they could follow the headwaters of the Fly and Strickland rivers, and from the north, they could go up the Sepik.
In 1926, Jack Carrius and Ivan Champion, two field officers of the Papuan administration, set out to cross from the Upper Fly to the Sepik River. They were trying to cross the island of New Guinea at its widest point. Like many other expeditions, its success depended on the ability of its leaders to get information from people who were meeting white men for the first time. Ivan Champion was 22 when the expedition left Port Moresby.
We left Port Moresby in the catch for Elevala, went to Daru, and picked up carriers there, and we went up there 500 miles up the river, and then we started off to go to cross New Guinea. We still hadn't got into the mountains, so we had to take our stores for a dash across the mountain, another 100 miles or so by track and winding. So you adopt the relay system. You have 30 or 40 men, carriers, some police, 12 police, and you make a camp in the bush. You carry your rice, the main food, forward 3 or 4 hours. You make another camp. Then those carriers go back the same day to the other camp, so they won't be eating the food at the forward camp. And so you go on and on, the slow drab. Anyway, we finally got into the mountains, the base of Mount Bluka, on the headwaters of the Palmer, tributary of the Fly. We couldn't speak to the natives. The ones we struck, they were all primitive. Nobody could speak to anyone. It was all sign language. And we made a base camp at the bottom of Mount Blücher on this Palmer River, the McGregor name, the headwaters of the Palmer, which the natives call the Wokluap. Wok means river. And Carrie said, well, I'm going over to see if I can cross that range. She's away, and you stop here at the base camp, and I'll take some police, and Carrie, and away we go. And he went off. I've forgotten how long he was away. Came back, and he said, well, tremendous mountains, and there's a river flowing that way, and I think that's part of the sea. The guy said, no, it's not. You haven't gone far enough. I was the map maker. Carius was a remarkable man. He never got downhearted, but he had no geographical sense. But he had a remarkable way with the natives. He never upset them. That's why he was chosen. And he said, I'm on that part where Berman shows it's travelling northeast. I said, no, you're not. Possible. Well, he said, I'm going to make a dash. We haven't got enough. You'll have to go back down the fly with the worst of the carriers who can't do the trip and some police. And off he went. And I said, I'm not going. I'm going to disobey orders. The natives used to come down. I start to pick up their language. I used to get a stone and put it on the ground. And I'd say, stone. And so this went on, and they'd look and they'd say something, and I'd keep on. Then I'd say, well, that's their word for stone. Then I'd get the river, wok, wok. And I realised Epperson meant a river. And I kept on. I'd say palm or something like that. And finally I'd get down, wok lua, you see. And then I kept pointing. They said they came from that direction, the opposite, northwesterly direction. And by my computations, I reckon that was the way to go to the Sepik, to find the headwaters of the Sepik. So I decided to go that way. We still had a lot of rice left we'd carried there, so I left the base camp there with... I only had five police left. I took two, and I left three at the base camp. I took about half a dozen carriers. I had 11 left, I think. So I went off on my own, and I received a great welcome from these people, these curious people, and on I went. We carried a bit of rice, and we carried salt and tray, because they all used stone adzes. They had no steel at all. They didn't have a tomahawk, a stone. It was an adze. They were taro eaters, not sweet potatoes, taro.
So you were using local intelligence, were you, to try and...
Oh, yes. And as I went, they gave me the name of the rivers and came up to this great mountain towering above us. It looked about 10,000 feet. I'd reached then 5,000 feet above sea level. I was going slowly along with these natives coming in and looking at the knife. And when I gave one a tomahawk, you see... He rushed at a tree and he didn't know how to use it. He tried to use it this way. We had to show him how to use it.
Tried to use it like an adze.
Yeah. Yeah. And we went on and I kept pointing. They said, Bolivit, Bolivit. And then I learned that Bolivit was their main village. And we crossed this divide, I think it was about 7,000 feet by then. There's a river, there's a great stony, no water, and suddenly... A few miles further, it gushed out from underground, all limestone, this river, and they called it the Bowl. Well, we camped there in the evening on the banks of this Bowl. So we spent the night, we started off the next morning with our guides, and they kept on Bolivit. Bolivit was getting closer and closer to their main village. And we went into the village and were greeted by these people. They made a tremendous fuss of us. They wore a great cassowary plume, and their dress was this penis gourd, these great things like that, and the woman wore a little grass skirt. And there a fella came out, he looked like one of these biblical characters, with his black beard and his cassowary plumes, and they hold out their hands like this, and you click. They click your hand and clench, then you clench, pull apart.
Clench fist and link like your little fingers and then pull them
click,
apart.
Click. And that's how. And then they kept the word Num Seno, they'd shout. And I learned it was my friend, and my police after used to call them the Num Seno Taudias, in Motu Taudias, people, Num Seno Taudias. And we camped there then, and I had little knives. Oh, and they rushed out, and I bought food for us, taro, and I kept bringing taro in and gazing at us. And then when I took my hat off, they just gasped. They thought it was part of me. And they started to feel my boots. They were astonished that I could take my hat off, because the police didn't wear hats. Then the old fella lined up a lot of women, and he kept pointing to them. I thought, my God, what's going to happen now? And then he brought a little boy about 10 years of old, very light-skinned. And he grabbed my hand like that, and he put the little boy's hand against it, and he pointed out with similar colour. And then he pointed to the sky, and he pointed to the boy. And then he made a sign, was I born of a woman? And he seemed to make out the boy came from the sky somewhere. And I learned after he pointed down, they'd found him and taken him, but not being able to speak to him, didn't know. Next day I stayed there and I tried to talk about this river. I kept pointing and great mountains over the range, was there another river going that way? I puzzled for a long time. Then they said we'd go off the next day. I said next day we'd go, and we went westward again. We came to the main Fly River. Oh, they tried to stop us going any further. They pointed out, they said, well, they call them the firewall men. Men meant people. Firewall men, if you go there, they eat people. No good. So I went back. I was getting away from my northerly roots. I still hadn't found the name of this river, which I wanted was the Sepik. They left me then for a day. I went on my own. Anyway, I decided to come back. And we got back into Bolivie late in the afternoon, and they thronged round as they got my carrying. They sat them down in front of the fire, and they fed them, and they patted them, and made a great fuss. And then I went on about this. Last I got it. Walk tucking, walk tucking. And they pointed, going that way, the way I thought it would be going. I said, this is it. And I thought, well, I can't do it. I can't go. We'd all die. We couldn't. I've got nobody. I couldn't go with no stores, nothing. Carriers of legs are sore. I had to go back down the river, of course. We walked down out of the mountains, and I made rafts. And we made three rafts to float down the river. We started on. We're still in the rapids. We wrecked the three rafts the second day. We had to rebuild them. What rice we had left, we had it in waterproof bag, oil bags. And I thought, well, they'll take too long to make canoes, and I'll stick to the rafts. And our rafts were made with three great logs, and they floated high, and put a platform on each, and we rowed them with the current, to keep them in the current. It took me a month to get down the Fly River in those rafts. And I stopped in the middle Fly, one side of the Fly. It was Dutch New Guinea then, and we struck a big camp of natives there one evening, and they came off shouting and going on. I thought I might be able to buy canoes, but I was a bit afraid. And we had five rifles and a few men, and they were a big crowd, and they had a reputation, so I kept moving. We started to go at night too, and we'd get into whirlpools, and we still had a hurricane lantern left in the lead. My raft was in the lead. I'd have this lantern so the others could follow me. One night, another crowd of natives came off in canoes, and several of them jumped aboard my raft, and they tried to steal the tomahawk, and we pushed them off, and we got rid of them. And we went on, and I finally got down into the estuary, about 100 miles up from the estuary mouth, and it came into was still fairly primitive. They had a village constable, so there we abandoned our raft under canoes, and we went down the river. At midnight, we're still travelling. We got near the first plantation, isolated plantation there. Saw lights ahead. We're ship anchored there, a fairly big boat. And as we rushed past, someone yelled, "Who are you?" And one of my police recognised one of Carius's fleets. And there was Carius on the boat coming up to look for me. This river turned out that he went down was a tributary of the Strickland. He had a terrible time. He got into a great limestone once they were crossing where a great landslide and they were nearly engulfed in it. But he got back before me and then he was ordered to come back and look for me. So we went back to Port Moresby and they said, well, see if Murray said you can try again.
Despite the rigours of the first attempt, Papua's Lieutenant Governor, Sir Hubert Murray, sent Charles Carius and Ivan Champion on their way again up the Fly River to attempt their crossing of New Guinea a mere 2 months later.
This time we didn't take Western carriers, mud men, we took D'Entrecasteaux, the islands of Samurai. They're wiry little fellows and we took them. We also took some volunteer long sentence prisoners. They're pretty good carriers, but they're hard and they've been in jail for many years. And they were very good, and we started again. This time we took a whole crowd. We had two boats, Illawarra and Minnetonka, and canoes. We went right up the river. This time there was a flood, and we got a bit further up with the boats, and we landed again, and then we rushed all these carriers through to Mount Blücher. One go, no relaying. But a huge crowd of men. We had the assistant resident magistrate and other officers from Daru to take the surplus people back. We had our picked 30 D'Entrecasteaux and six police to do the final journey. And Carius said, well, we'll go your way. Well then, first day out from Mount Blücher, camped there, and I had these fellows recognise me and they came round and I said, walk tucking, walk tucking, walk tucking. I kept hammering in, walk tucking, that's where we're going, walk tucking. They looked a bit down and then they made sign language. There was no food in the district. They, all the time when I was there, they did, they fed us with great tiredness. It was apparently a drought on them, no food. And I said to Kerry, my God, it doesn't look too good. He said, my God, I hope you're not leading me on a blind trial. No, we'll get. Anyway, we got to Bolivie and they had this sad story. I saw the old chief there, the old fella again. We carried a big adze with us. We carried that so we could make canoes, hollow out canoes. And I said, walk tucking. And he shook his head, no walk tucking. We weren't going to take us to walk tucking. And I pointed this sign, you take us to walk tucking, this is yours. Well, a lot of talk, so we lined up to start the next morning. They said you had to go up these great mountains the next morning, and we were all ready to start. And they said they might come the evening before. Nothing happened, nobody. They looked at us from out. And I brandished this adze and tomahawks, and all of a sudden he gave the word, and he and six or seven, they rushed, come. Away we went. We went for a couple of hours and they said, up there. And this great mountain, it looked perpendicular. So they had a track, but only they could see a track, you know. Their tracks, they only had bamboo knives and these stone adzes. And you couldn't see their tracks. And they took, I think, about 2 or 3 hours to climb to the first summit. We climbed to the... You reach up with your hand, forward. You say, how those carriers carry the bags of rice slung over their shoulders? The 40 pounds weight they were carrying. Went up and up and reached the first little plateau and the old fella made signs to them. And we waited and I remember when he little D'Entrecasteaux man, he didn't look much bigger than his. He got up there and he flung his bag of rice down. He looked around and he went, pah! He said, Motu, police motu, 10 bob for all this. Anyway, the old fellow, we waited till the remainder came up. Carius came behind the crowd and we waited and we started off again. They led us on this terrible limestone country. It's all covered in scrub and stuff, moss. I remember we saw a cuscus up a tree, so I shot it. I gave it to the old chap, the old fellow leading us, and he wouldn't touch it. He pointed to the hole and I wouldn't touch it. It was done by this boom. So we went on and we camped one night with no water at all. We squeezed the water out of the moss to cook the rice. Some of them were still carrying taro too, we had. I've forgotten how many days. And finally, I remember the last day before we saw the Waktuk, and it was rain during that night, and we got a bit of water then. And it was a very dirty, misty morning, and we came out onto a grass patch and a rock. And there was our Tamsimara was his name. Tamsimara, he's standing there, and he said, Waktuk in, dim, dim, dim. And there it was, flowing this great grass valley in front of us. And I remember all the carriers came in, they said, Rabaul River, Rabaul River. It was the Waktucking. The smoke from many villages where we'd come was a very small population. This looked much bigger. Anyway, he took us down the mountain. Going down the mountain, I hit my knee on a limestone outcrop. Coming across the so you could hear water underneath, caves and things, but you couldn't see it. Gurgling water. And we went down and we got to the first village and the crowds, he beckoned them in and the old chap made speeches about how we'd come to his village and so on. So we couldn't understand, only by sign language. And then we pointed out we wanted food, and we found they were right. There was very little food. We were in a bit of a pickle. We couldn't get enough to feed ourselves. We had to break open our precious rice. And they were pointing out there was famine. He pointed sign language. When I first came, they had plenty of food. Now there was none. And anyway, he said they was going back. He told these people, we want to go down the Waktuking. So he got in and he made a speech to him. You would see he was telling him how I came to his village and made friends with him and he gave him knives and so on, and they sort of said, look after them, he's going back. And then he said, called his men, took my finger like that, and carried his finger, clicked them off, and away he went. Well, anyway, we crossed the Tuckin and waded across the Tuckin there, the little tiny creek, the Sepikhead waters. This was grass country with patches of scrub, all grass country, and there was this great valley going down. Anyway, we went down and my knee started to give me trouble. It swelled up, I could hardly walk. We got into the great gorge in the Sepik. We still found the natives had come up with bows and arrows and they didn't know what to do, and we got very little food, very frightened. We made friends with them, but they were nothing like the Bolivite people that were so friendly. And days we went on, we got lost and we found their tracks and none of them came to us. And then we came to a river. It was gorgeous for miles and miles. It was a great sea, it was a big river then. It was a Loyacane Bridge. Well, by that time I'd collapsed with my leg. I couldn't walk. So they made a canvas stretcher for me, our sleeping beds. We had a slit of canvas we used to put poles through that were our beds. And these carriers, because we had carriers to spare then, we had very little food left, men without anything, so someone carried me there. And two police took me over the suspension bridge. It took 2 hours to get me across. This great river, you see? Has one thick lawyer cane on the bottom and then handrails, all lawyer cane on top, and it sways. And with me in this, I couldn't walk at all. Finally, they got me across. We got some natives there on the other side, gave us food. We were able to buy some food. And I went on for a couple of weeks. We got the river getting wider and got out of the gorges. And my leg had got all right and I was able to walk again. And then we came to a part of the river, out of the mountains, and the river was still a terrific pace, huge river. And I've always been a waterman, I was a good swimmer, I was a champion swimmer in my schoolboy days. And I said, I'll raft this river and care, he's a bit wiser. And he said, no, you can't. He said, if you'd like to try it, but you go with nothing, We had two or three police from the northern district who were used to rough rivers, torrent rivers, and we made one raft and we got on it. We'd only gone 100 yards and it just went over and over and over. And there we were in this boiling cauldron. And I always wore glasses, I lost my glasses. I could see fairly well without them. And I was hauled out, I remember, by the corporal. He hauled me ashore. We all got ashore. We were about five of us. Carius had gone on ahead. We caught him up. Police lost all their rifles. And that hurt them more than anything. They were shamed. Policeman without his rifle. They were absolutely ashamed. We got back and was going, he said, I told you so. So we went on and on. We got into Sago Swamp, that terrible. We made sago to eke out food. And finally we got to a place where we decided to make canoes. And we met natives in canoes coming up the river. And they were talking about something down the river going boom, 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 boom. We couldn't make out what it was. We thought, they must be talking about 20 years ago, Germans up here, boom, boom, boom. And we made our canoes and we started off, escorted by these days, late afternoon, there we shot round the bend. There was the boom, boom. There was the Elevala, the ship that had taken us up the fly. They'd sent her round up the Sepik. And the captain of the Elevala said, I've been here 3 weeks waiting for you people. I was going tomorrow, giving you up, you're lost. That was the end of the journey. We never fired a rifle in anger, and we never got an arrow in anger. One of our carriers died where we were making the canoes. That was the only loss we had on that trip.
Carius and Champion had been on patrol for 11 months. They had conformed to the ideals of the Papuan Field Service. They had taken risks rather than use force. They had shown great skill as bushmen, and they paid generous tribute to their police and carriers. But they had missed the broad and densely populated valleys of the Central Highlands. Missionaries and miners, climbing out of the Markham, were the first foreigners to look on the intensely gardened highland valleys. In the meantime, the Papuan officers kept cutting tracks across the blank areas on their maps. Their expeditions were so modest in cost and equipment, and so extravagant in time and human endurance. In 1935, Jack Hides and Jim O'Malley walked for 5.5 months from the Strickland River through the southern highlands to the Purari. Hides wrote of the wonderland they'd passed through and of the sharp moments of violence.
30 or 40 yards farther on, still running, I stumbled into an ambush of two armed natives. I don't know how I missed the arrow that was fired at me by the foremost native. I was conscious only of two black faces and of something that shut my eyes as I stumbled and tried to halt. Amesi was close behind me and he had quickly realised the position. Silly, Taupeta! And he had fired from behind me at the same time as I brought my own gun into play. I saw one of my assailants fling up his bow and arrows and follow the other native, whom by now I could hear crashing through the bush below us. But this second native didn't go far. He turned around and, with a gesture of appeal, slumped down to the ground. I ran forward to him, but he was dead when I reached his side in an attempt to succor him. There was a clean bullet wound through his chest. A feeling of pity and sadness came over me as I looked on this lifeless body. And later, every call of these primitive people as they searched the forest for this missing brother struck a guilty note in my heart. I will always regret the shooting of this native, for I knew his people had looked upon us as invaders, and I'd been prepared to risk a lot to save them from their fear. But the ambush had been thrust upon us so quickly, and after the arrow had been fired at me, neither Amesi nor I had much time to stop and think.
Later, the members of the patrol, almost exhausted and with few trade goods left to exchange for food, were forced to fight off attack after attack. And like Carius and Champion further west, they had to cross the limestone barrier. The police called it the Broken Bottle Country. But Hides had the reward that all the frontier men dreamed about. He broke through those desolate, dangerous ranges to look on a land that was beautiful in itself and everywhere marked by the works of a numerous and industrious people. Hides savoured that moment.
As we looked excitedly northwards, O'Malley and myself stood spellbound, gazing at a scene of wild and lonely splendour. Below us, on the opposite side of the Ryan River, a large lake lay on a platform of the divide, while the Ryan itself was seen to emerge from a deep gorge about 2 miles to the northwards. And beyond the gorge, gold and green, reaching as far as the eye could see, lay the rolling, timbered slopes and grasslands of a huge valley system. On every slope were cultivated squares, while little columns of smoke rising in the still air revealed to us the homes of the people of this land. I had never seen anything more beautiful. Beyond all stood the heights of some mighty mountain chain that sparkled in places with the colours of the setting sun. As I looked on those green, cultivated squares of such mathematical exactness, I thought of wheat fields or the industrious areas of a colony of Chinese. Here was a population such as I had sometimes dreamed of finding.
Jack Hides was restless, romantic, and courageous. Born in Port Moresby, he joined the government service at 19. After the Strickland-Purari Patrol of 1935, he left the public service to lead a disastrous and exhausting search for gold on the Strickland River. He died soon after his return to Sydney. He was 31. Hides had little more than a basic primary education, but he wrote 4 books. One, Papuan Wonderland, is a simple, strong and engaging account of the 1935 patrol. Hides had that sensitivity and command of language to write one of the best of the many books written by the outside men of the Papua New Guinea service. With Jack Hides at the small Port Moresby School for White Children, there had been the 3 champion brothers, Ivan, Alan and Claude. All joined the Papuan Field Service. 6 years before the Strickland-Purari Patrol, a youthful Claude Champion had gone north to the edge of the Southern Highlands. He just missed being among the first foreigners to see those heavily populated valleys.
In 1929, I went on a patrol with Barter William Faithorne. He was an assistant resident magistrate, and I was a patrol officer. We went from Kikori across the Murray Range at about 9,000 or 10,000 feet into the Samburigi Valley. Now, other officials had been to the Samburigi Valley before, but they didn't go further on. They returned from there after staying several days. We spent several days walking northwest and then northeast to a village called Ferrimy. On the way we pass hundreds of hamlets and onto the what they call the Eravi River. Now that, I think, is the Southern Highlands. The Eravi is the headwaters of the Purari River. And our instructions were to follow the Purari, or this river as we knew it as the Purari, Eravi, down to the mouth. Well, it was a terrific journey. We couldn't leave the river too far because we were frightened we may lose it. And some of the gorges we had to go through were absolutely terrific. And of course, we had to leave the river at certain times to get round the gorges. Higher up at Ferrimy, I got one of the police to climb a very high tree, and he saw a huge valley to the east, and I think it was sort of the headwaters of one of the huge valleys that the Lay brothers finally discovered.
The Lay brothers began their explorations into the highlands from the east on the New Guinea side in 1930, which will be described in our next program. Meanwhile, on the Papuan side, Claude Champion was to lead another major pre-war patrol into the Southern Highlands.
In February 1937, I got a letter from the government secretary. I was a diaru at the time, saying I had to lead a patrol to Lake Kudabu. And we had to find our own means to get there, whether we went overland a certain way and then cross the river and then walk again. And I thought it'd be better if we went up the river by canoes, towed a certain way and then paddle the rest of the way. Well, I was told my European assistant, which was George Anderson, and I decided to take 12 native police, and we started off with over 100 carriers. But I selected most of my police. When I say most of them, about four or five I knew very well, I'd had on patrol before. Some I had to get from other districts, and they were so loyal, and I knew that if I was in trouble, they're the men to get you out of trouble. And when I say we had 100 carry, we had over 100 to start with, but that's to get the food to take it up to a certain spot on the river and then send most of the carriers back and keep 36 carriers and relay the food to Lake Kudabu. Well, relaying is very difficult. You go until 3 or 4 hours, good walking, but you don't give them a meal because it means that what you've carried forward you're going to eat. So you send them back pretty smartly for the next load, and they get in about 5 or 6 o'clock at night. Well, 6 o'clock up there is dark, just about dark, and it's a back-breaking job. We hated it, but it had to be done. And eventually, when we got to Lake Kudabu, everyone was very happy indeed. But before we left the river, I dug a big hole and put in, I suppose, 20 cans of rice. All the rice was put in kerosene tins and salted up. That was for, of course, stop the water getting in. And in the canoes, if you capsize, they will float. A quarter of them will be above water and you rescue them. From Lake Kudabu, we had to patrol the valleys of the Wela, Tari and Wagi valleys. That was a 6 weeks patrol, and some of the places Hides had been to, and one of the places in the Wela where he had a terrific fight killing a lot of people. And the first people who greeted us with bows and arrows, but they made signs, they didn't want any boong-boongy. We put our rifles down, and eventually the natives put their bows and arrows down, and we gave them some shell. We called the Myrie shell. It's the gold lip shell. We gave them some of that, and then they went off and got food. And that's how we made friends with them. And some days later, we cross a very high mountain. As a matter of fact, it was the coldest night I have ever spent in my life. We crossed at 11,000 feet. When I say cross, we couldn't cross. We got caught at 11,000. And Anderson and I were going up with the police, hitting the carriers, not belting them with sticks, but hitting them with open hands to keep the circulation going. We knew once they stopped, they'd die. So we eventually got them into camp at 11,000 feet, and it was limestone country and no water. But we could hear a creek right down below, and there was a hole big enough to get a bucket down. And we lowered the bucket and got water, enough to cook their rice, enough for us to cook our food. Of course, no one had a bath. And the next morning, we didn't get up very early, and the natives built fires to keep themselves warm. And then We set off about 9 o'clock, and that's when the trouble started, the yodeling from everywhere. Hides warned us about the yodeling. If they start to yodel, watch your step. And down, when we eventually got in the valley, a long spear grass, and in the valleys they have long trenches dug for defense purposes. They're about 10 feet deep and about 9 feet wide. That was for protection from other natives. Anyway, we got into a clearing, quite a big clearing, and these thousands of natives surrounded us with bows and arrows, yodeling and all ready at the draw. And my native cook boy, who played the mouth organ very well indeed, came and sat down and played the mouth organ. I was at one end of the carrier line with some police. Anderson was at the other end. My cook boy, Nacy, started to play the mouth organ. The natives had never heard anything like this in their lives. And they just stood stock still, put their bows and arrows down. I said, Nacy, keep playing, keep playing. And one of them heard the name Nacy. He ran up, Nacy, Nacy. And they all dropped their bows and arrows and just sat and listened to him. And personally, I think he just saved the whole party. And that night when we camped, they brought us tons and tons of sweet potatoes, but only if he would play the mouth organ again. And that's what he did. After I had returned from Lake Kudabu, after very strenuous patrolling of 7 months, I was very tired and haggard, and I had to write a report, and then it had to go into Port Moresby, and of course read by Sir Hubert Murray, and he said to the government secretary, what a wonderful patrol Claude did. Isn't it a shame he spelt exorbitant with an H? I thought after 7 months, I thought he might have found something better to say than that.
Next, the promised land, the push into the highlands from the east, and in particular, the exploratory patrols of the Lay brothers, who went in looking for gold in 1930. During the next few years, they were to be involved in some remarkable journeys which helped reveal to the outside world the immense population living in the wide grassy valleys of the highlands, surely one of the most exciting exploration and discovery stories of modern times. In Into the Highlands, you heard the voices of Ivan Champion and his brother Claude Champion. Readings were by Neil Fitzpatrick. Comment was by Dr. Hank Nelson, Fellow in the Department of Pacific and Southeast Asian History at the Australian National University.